It's my honor to speak with Danica Savonik about her marvelous book entitled Open Admissions, The Poetics and Pedagogy of Tony Cade Bambara, June Jordan, Audre Lorde, and Adrienne Rich in the Era of Free College. This is a riveting and deeply inspiring story of how each of these luminaries in the fields of literature and feminism found their way into the City University of New York in the 1960s, when community activists had forced open what was called the Harvard for the Proletariat to admit new classes of Black, Brown, and other people of color. Savonik shows, through copious archival research, how Bambara, Jordan, Lorde, and Rich each came to find radical teaching methods in collaboration with these new students, and how their experiences with this new pedagogy affected their creative and other writing in profound and lasting manners. This is a critical history we can and must learn from today, when federal and state governments have added to the damage and violence done by the neoliberal university. We find the tools and models we need to create spaces for education for liberation, both within but also outside the academy. Speaking Out of Place is produced in collaboration with The Creative Process and is made with support from Stanford University. I alone am responsible for its content. We hope you enjoy this and other episodes. Please help support Speaking Out of Place by subscribing via our website, speakingoutofplace.com, following us on Instagram, and following me on Blue Sky. You can give me your feedback and suggest people to invite and topics to cover. Also, please check out my book of the same title, published by Haymarket Books. Kianga Yamata Taylor calls it, quote, the exact book we need for the troubled historical moment through which we are living. Thank you so much for being on the show. It's a great book. Before we start talking about it in particular, I'm really fascinated to know, how did you stumble onto the idea for this book? What led you to study this program and discover who was involved and how they were involved?
Sure. So I began working on this project around 2012, 2013, when I was a PhD student at the CUNY Graduate Center. And at that time, I started organizing with a group called the Free University of New York City, which was an offshoot of Occupy Wall Street. And we organized pop-up universities in parks throughout the city. So I was really interested kind of in the idea of free college, the history of free college. At that time, student debt had just surpassed the $1 trillion mark. And I saw how that was affecting the lives of so many students, so many of my friends and others. And so we were just experimenting with how else higher education could look if it was free in these parks throughout the city. And then at the same time, I also started teaching writing at Queens College, which is a campus within the CUNY system. And I was reading the works of people like Paulo Freire and bell hooks and thinking about what can I do in these classrooms to empower my students and help them think about the inequalities in our society, help empower them to challenge those inequalities, help them develop skills that would be useful for them. And so as I was reading hooks and Freire and teaching, a colleague recommended to me Adrienne Rich's essay, Teaching Language in Open Admissions. And so it was in that essay that I first read about her experiences teaching at CUNY during open admissions, learning that she taught alongside June Jordan, Audre Lorde, Tony Cade Bambara. And eventually that essay then led me to their archival teaching materials. And I was really excited because I found in those materials concrete teaching methods, things that they were doing in their own classrooms that I then started trying in my classrooms as well. I also really just liked their educational philosophies and just thinking about what it means for college to be free and the fact that they were teaching during this revolutionary era and what would that look like today? What would it mean? What could free college bring to our society? What does free college make possible? And so it was all of those things coming together that led me to the project.
Well, it's a great story because one of the things that fascinates me about the book and the reason that I put it on my syllabus and the course that I'm talking about is called Scholarship and Activism. In the academy, we're used to partitioning the two, right? I hear stories from our graduate students in other departments, for example, working in sustainability or other areas, and their advisors will say, I really admire your passion, which is always the worst way to begin a conversation because you know what's going to come next, right? They say, I admire your passion. You're here to learn. not to be an activist. And so there's a kind of disciplining that begins and is contagious in the academy. And the story that you tell, both in terms of your own experience and coming to write this book, but the lives that you write about in the book, show that's not necessarily the case at all. In fact, there's so many things that benefit from people disobeying that partitioning. And our minds don't work in those very strict ways. Could you tell us about the SEEK program, which is the Search for Education, Elevation, and Knowledge? How and why did it begin? And how did these four amazing writers each find their way there? I thought it was really fascinating that they came from different backgrounds, but they saw something in this program that was catalytic in their formation. So talk about the program.
Yeah, sure. So the SEEK program was formed in 1965. It was the product of community organizing and activism within Harlem. So this happened at City College. City College was established in 1847 as the Free University of New York City. It was supposed to be this experiment in educating the working class and expanding higher education. And it was a great success. And actually, throughout the late 19th and early 20th century, it became this kind of gem. It was known as the Harvard of the proletariat. Yeah. And it was really seen as like an inspiring kind of model for free college education for the working classes. But throughout the late 19th and early 20th century, the demand far outstripped the number of students that they were able to educate at City College. And so what actually ended up happening is that administrators used exclusive admissions criteria to decide who would gain access to these coveted seats. So things like you had to have over a B+ average in your high school curriculum. And so the students who ended up attending were primarily young Jewish men, like my grandfather, Irish immigrants or the children of immigrants, Catholic, Italian immigrants, but it was primarily white students who were attending. And by the 1960s, somewhere between 94% to 97% of the students attending this great free working class college were white. And the kind of hypocrisy or the irony of this, you know, this college located in Harlem that is then 94% to 97% white, funded by all taxpayers, regardless of race or creed. Activists became concerned with the racial exclusion of the college, and they wanted the college to educate more Black and Puerto Rican students from the surrounding community. And so in 1964, you had activists from CORE get together with Black and Puerto Rican parents and students and community members. Progressive politicians were also on board in the struggle to challenge the racial exclusion at City College. You had Shirley Chisholm was involved, Percy Sutton. There were lots of big historical names in New York politics who got involved in the fight to open up City College. And so in 1965, as a result of their activism, the SEEK program was born. And it was a program designed to recruit economically and educationally disenfranchised students from throughout the surrounding Harlem community and throughout New York City. And what the program did was it waived any enrollment fees for students. And it gave them money that they could use for transportation to college, for on-campus housing, money for books, and it gave them access to specialized, individualized tutoring, personalized counseling. They would come to college the summer beforehand and take all of these classes that would get them up to speed and help prepare them to matriculate at City College. And so one of the other things I should mention is the program recruited students of color, students who are economically disenfranchised, who didn't meet the normal entrance requirements that normally they would have needed, that high B+ average to get into City College. But they worked with counselors in the local high schools to identify students who showed academic promise, who they thought could succeed. And Bombara, Jordan, Lord, and Rich all ended up teaching in this SEEK program. So they were teaching basic writing, they were teaching remedial writing, really lower level entry classes that even a lot of the faculty in the English department didn't want to teach. Yeah. There was this tiered system where writing classes were seen as almost the handmaiden of literature, the basic, uninteresting, labor-intensive work that the tenured faculty, who are predominantly white men in the English department, didn't really want to do. And so the college hired all of these activists, writers, to teach in the program. And they saw it as an opportunity to work with Black and Puerto Rican students and to help really empower these students and help them gain access to a college education. And together, they taught alongside some really prominent poets from the Black arts movement, like David Henderson and Raymond Patterson. You had up-and-coming literature scholars like Barbara Christian and Addison Gale, all of these just like really big names. At the time, this was much earlier in their careers. But they all came together to teach in this really revolutionary and groundbreaking program, which in the years to come would go on to become a model for similar programs at universities throughout the country.
Can you tell us what the pushback was? Because that was one thing that was not unsurprising, but certainly depressing. When you talk about this wonderful vision that CUNY had, and then precisely when there was this notion you would get a different demographic coming in, talk about the kind of reaction of a lot of the white professors to that new population.
Yeah, a lot of them were concerned that these students would tarnish the college's reputation as the Harvard of the proletariat. They really took pride.
Very narrow notion of the proletariat. So much for racial capitalism is it going to be.
Yeah, exactly. So they didn't want these students because they thought, that the school's reputation would decrease. They thought the students wouldn't be able to handle the curriculum. They just didn't want to teach these students who were coming in and needed a bit more like remedial help in the beginning. But then over the years, very quickly succeeded once they had that a little bit of additional support, especially with financial matters and that personalized tutoring and counseling to make up for the absences in their K-12 education. They really succeeded almost in some instances, despite the white professors who were really mean to Sikh students, did some really awful things to them, humiliating them and berating them and embarrassing them in front of their peers. So yeah, you had faculty administrators during this period writing books like Jeffrey Wagner's The End of Education, saying that this kind of opening up of the city college would destroy higher education, when in fact these writers, these activists saw it as quite the opposite. They're like, this is what the future of higher education needs to look like. We need to actually hold City College accountable to its democratic mission to educate the children of the people, the whole people, right? Not just a select few. And yeah, so disheartening definitely to see that kind of pushback.
Were they not cognizant of the fact that the same thing was said about working class people coming to university, that it would lower this?
Exactly.
The Harvard of the proletariat was supposed to pad the accent on Harvard, not proletariat, obviously, in that regard.
And exactly.
So tell us how each of these four came into this program.
So Babara was the first one to teach. She was one of the inaugural educators in the Sikh program. She pioneered a lot of the student-centered teaching methods that the program would come to be famous for. So she had grown up in Harlem. She went to Queens College for undergrad. She was getting her master's at City College in the literature department. And I think a lot of the people on campus just recognized her genius and her brilliance, and she had a passion for working with these students. She wanted to use her gifts and talents to serve Black and Puerto Rican working class communities. So I think she was a natural fit for that program to spearhead that. The next one who arrived was June Jordan. And Jordan had been a political organizer. She'd been writing for different publications about Black liberation struggles. She dipped in and out of college. She had a few years in Chicago. She had a few years at Barnard, but she didn't actually have a college degree. She had a lot of professional experience as a writer, but not those kind of formal qualifications. And so she was pretty thrilled that this program would accept an instructor who had an unconventional pathway maybe to the program, and they still hired her to teach freshman writing. And then Adrienne Rich, she was teaching at Columbia, and she deliberately left. She very easily could have stayed on at Columbia, but she wanted to teach instead in the Sikh program because she believed in the mission, right? She wanted to empower working class students of color. She was really struck by the protests that had happened at Columbia in 1968 and the ways that the students were critiquing Columbia's complicity in racism and imperialism. And this is the period of her radicalization, right? So she decided to leave Columbia to teach instead at City College and to specifically teach in the Sikh program. So they had offered her a more prestigious position. Oh, maybe you want to teach like our creative writing MFA students. And she said, no, I want to teach basic writing and remedial writing. And then in Audre Lorde's case, she had grown up in New York City. She was writing some of her early poetry collections. She had gone down to Tupelo College in Mississippi. She had been invited as a visiting writer. And she was really struck and transformed even by just those like 6 weeks that she spent working with students. And she realized that teaching was her life calling and her passion. And so when she returned and came back to New York City, she was eager for more teaching opportunities. And she was then hired to teach at City College in the Sikh program. And she would go on for the rest of her career to teach actually at a number of different colleges within the big public CUNY university system.
What an amazing four people to be in this program. You know, it's just you couldn't wish for anything more. So you're right. Adrienne Rich was the one I had in mind as somebody who came from a very different kind of context. And you tell the story about how there are certain transformations that she went through, and often she was at odds with one of the other three people who came in or her students. Now she's in this new environment.
So when Rich came to the Sikh program, she knew things were going to be different, right, from teaching at Columbia, but she wasn't exactly sure how. So she was coordinating with Myna Shaughnessy, who was then in charge of the writing program, to get syllabi of what other educators had done and adapt and use those as models for her own. So we know from looking at her archives at the Schlesinger Library up at Radcliffe, she has Tony Cade Bambara's like syllabi for her first Sikh courses. So she was very much building off of what Addison Gale and Tony Cade Bambara and Barbara Christian had done in the first years of the Sikh program. Those are sitting right there in Rich's archives for her to adapt and rework. So she, I would say, had almost a kind of like racial and class awakening in her experiences in the Sikh program. One of the things that interests me is today she's remembered as one of the few white feminists of her generation who actually addressed issues of race and class rather than prioritizing the interests of middle and upper class white women within the women's movement. And I really think that those experiences were shaped by her time teaching students in the Sikh program and working with them, figuring out what their needs are, listening to them, adjusting her teaching methods, right? She did more teaching, like actual teaching students how to do things. I think when she was teaching in Columbia's MFA program, her feedback on students' poetry was like, yeah, this is great. I really like this. This is awesome. It wasn't very instructive. But in the Sikh program, you see her developing step-by-step instructions, not in an overly prescriptive and didactic way, but hey, if you're scared about writing, here's how I do it. Here are some steps you can try taking and see if they work for you. But also, she was reading things like the work of Frederick Douglass. And when she was teaching in Sikh, she was studying the history of slavery in the U.S. in order to prepare her lectures and her class material and to prepare for those discussions that she'd be having with students. So you see her studying the histories of institutional racism in the United States, which hadn't been part of her own education really previously. And so you see in these classrooms her developing these sort of intersectional sensibilities that she then comes to write about in that essay Teaching Language in Open Admissions. You see her adapting the methods of Bambara and Jordan, also like having their students analyze the quality of their education. And so they would read essays by George Orwell or Alfred North Whitehead about what education should look like. And then they would use those criteria or develop their own and analyze the institutional conditions, the schools that they had gone through, whether that was City College or their K-12 schools. So yeah, it was a really kind of transformative experience for her. And she became really passionate about teaching in Sikh. And for the rest of her career, even after she left City College and went on to teach at other institutions like Douglas College, which was part of Rutgers, when she went on to teach at San Jose State in California and Stanford, she was really an advocate for the downward redistribution of educational resources. Mm-hmm. So she continued to advocate for free college, for open admissions, for funding for remedial writing programs. So I think that time in Sikh really shaped her perspective on education and what it should look like.
Yeah, it was a wonderful story. And your archive is amazing. As you say, you have these lesson plans and syllabi and often indications of the kinds of back and forth with students. Which lesson plans or syllabi really struck you as being very adaptive to the environment and yielding an extraordinary kind of pedagogy or a type of pedagogy?
Yeah, thank you. And I should note for listeners, if you want to learn more about their teaching materials, there is this great initiative at CUNY called the Lost and Found Poetics Documents Initiative, and they publish excerpts of Jordan's, Bambara's, and Lord's teaching material. So you can go look at and read. They're available freely online, which is amazing because teacher poets were always sharing and exchanging resources among themselves. So I'm so happy that these exist freely online for people to go look at. So I'm always really drawn to both Bambara and Jordan's teaching materials. I think those two, perhaps more so than any of the other figures, have really influenced my own teaching. They both developed this approach in Sikh that they would again continue building on throughout their careers. The two aspects that emerge from the teaching archives that I think were really responsive to the moment, but also somehow continue to resonate today. So the first one is the ways that these teacher poets gave their students agency and control and asked them to exercise collective self-determination in shaping what their courses would look like. And so Bambara, in this remedial summer writing program that she was teaching for students in the Sikh program, she fully turned the content, direction, and goals of the course over to students. She wanted them to decide what they would be learning and in what order, what they would be reading, what kinds of assignments they'd be doing, and on what terms they would agree to participate in the course. So rather than deciding those ahead of time and kind of top-down enforcing them upon students, she actually wanted to get students involved in that collective decision-making process, which I think speaks so much to the discourses of self-determination, the movement for the community of control for schools, all of these things that were emerging from Black liberation movements in the 60s and 70s really informed her thinking about classrooms. And I think they did a great job in helping these students who had been really alienated from their K through 12 education. Many of them had been taught that they weren't good at writing. They had been told that they weren't good at school. And I think involving them in collective decisions about what they were going to read, what they were going to study, I think that was so powerful in helping them reclaim a sense of agency over their learning, but also practice skills like collective decision-making. And how are we as a group of 25 or 30 people going to work towards a course that we all agree upon and feel good about and feel like we're going to learn from? And so that semester, the topic that they picked for their course, this was a remedial writing course. So they could have picked any subject to study. And they picked colonialism, neocolonialism, and liberation. Wow. And so that course ended up focusing on the wave of decolonial movements in Africa, the war in Vietnam, and also what was known as the internal colonialism of U.S. racism at the time. And so they read widely about these subjects. And that class concluded with students doing an open-ended final project. So this is something that Bambara did often and that I found really useful in my own classes, which is concluding the semester with saying to students, like, I want you to create something that can take what you've learned and then apply it and make it useful for audiences beyond the classroom, right? So there's this line that she always said that really resonates with me. She said, "Do not write term papers for me. Make sure they are useful for somebody else as well." And so she'd suggest some options. She's maybe you might want to create a short story. You might want to create a radio broadcast. Maybe it's a street theater performance. Maybe you're going to create a literary magazine. Maybe you're going to create a syllabus for a new course. So she would give them options, but it was up to students to decide how will you take all of the things that you've learned this semester and share them with a broader audience and make them useful to audiences beyond the classroom. So I really just, I love that approach. And I've found even with my own students, asking them to do some version of that, whether that's creating a digital timeline or like a digital anthology, a podcast, I've found that's been super effective with students.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, because inadvertently in one of my classes on the climate crisis, I asked students to do exactly that. And one of the groups came up with a great, of course, we're talking about Silicon Valley, so it was an app. And the problem was when you do things like you recycle, you do individual act, often you don't get a sense of how it matters beyond that individual. So they created an app where anybody could log in any place in the world, say, today I took out this, and it would all aggregate all the individual actions into one thing. So all of a sudden,
So that's awesome.
And the other thing that in the book, one of the professors says, along the lines of what you were saying, they ask students to comment on a particular issue in their lives. Right? It's asking them for their lived experience and how this problem of this or that could be understood via these different kinds of approaches. And I'm very glad that you mentioned how you have adapted it to your own teaching. I love that kind of genealogy that's lateral. It's not, as you say, it's not top down, but encourages students to speak to other generations of students in some way.
Yeah. And I guess I would also add, there is such a good focus on encouraging students to write about their lived experiences. That was a super important part of their pedagogy. But they also balanced that with having students research the structural social issues that were unfolding in their communities. So June Jordan has this assignment that she called the problem paper assignment, mm-hmm. where students would select an issue that was damaging their communities, right? So some of the topics students talked about were like low test scores, drug addiction, lack of access to high quality foods, for K through 12 schools. And so they would research these social structural issues in their communities. And Jordan would always encourage them to think about the public policy decisions and the kind of decisions about how resources are going to be distributed, how those affect their particular communities. And they would also research possible solutions, right? So here's like a list of ways people have thought about addressing inferior education in my community. And then they would have to evaluate and take a stand on which one they think is most effective. So it's that balancing of lived experiences, but also researching and studying the problems in their communities, because many of these students came to college because they wanted to address social problems in our society, just the way our students today, they come to college hungry to address these issues. So it's that balance of writing about their lived experiences, but also doing research on those problems that they want to solve.
Yeah, and the solutions come organically from the folks, right? You mentioned before, we were talking about Paulo Freire and this whole notion against the banking model of education, but even like classic organizers like Saul Alinsky and what he called gutter politics, which was not getting down to the gutter, but rather building gutters. And what does the neighborhood need? They need a gutter. And so it's really looking at your life and changing the material circumstances of your life and for others, rather than plugging into or adapting something from above that says, you need this, you need that, from people who don't live anywhere near where you live or experience life in the way that you experience it at all. The other thing that I was interested in was, because we've talked a little bit about the syllabi and the pedagogy, but you also mentioned how this pedagogy spills over into different ways of writing, both in terms of the individuals that we're talking about, but also these great projects of anthologizing, right? They're changing the way the publishing industry is working to some degree. So could you talk about both those things, how these four women are changing their writing on the basis of this new pedagogical experience and pedagogical communities that they're entering into? And then all of these anthologies, which I thought were really so impressive and interesting.
Sure, yeah. So at the same time that these women were developing new teaching methods, reading the educational philosophies of Freire and others, they would sit in also on each other's classes and observe and take notes on teaching methods.
Do you have their notes? Do you actually have notes that they took? That would be amazing.
Oh, I have their reflections. They were like, oh, sitting in on this lecture, I observed that none of the students were listening. So maybe we need to try something other than
That's
lecturing.
Great.
Yeah, I think Adrienne Rich like tallied. She was like, this many students were paying attention. This many students were like doodling in their notebook. So she would sit and just watch like what works and what doesn't work. I love that kind of observational experiential research they were doing on teaching. But yeah, so at the same time that they were doing all of these things, not to mention supporting their students' activism, their students who are organizing for changes to curriculum, to have more Black and ethnic studies, to further open the university to more students of color. So they were doing all the teaching, supporting their students' activism, but they were also writing poems, short stories, novels, essays, fiction that was inspired by these experiences. These classrooms led to the flourishing of these different literary genres. So one example of this is June Jordan's young adult novel, His Own Where, which was published in 1971. It was written in Black English. It was like a really acclaimed A novel of the time. It's a rewriting of Romeo and Juliet. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I thought was really interesting is that, and she said some version of this when she's reflecting on the book and its aims, but the book is in some ways an effort to share with young readers the ways of seeing and thinking and addressing social problems that she was teaching her City College students. So we just talked about the problem paper assignment where she was having them research social issues in their local communities. And then with this young adult novel, His Own Where, you have the main protagonist, Buddy. He has that same kind of structural sensibility, right? And he's always analyzing the social problems in his neighborhood using that same kind of framework and way of seeing that she was trying to encourage in her classrooms as well. He also has this really vivid imagination, and he's always thinking about other ways of rearranging physical spaces and rearranging social life to better promote flourishing. He's this visionary character who's always thinking about what other ways could we organize society. And so I think very much those questions that she was taking up in her classrooms also came through in her writing. And the writing, in a way, was a way that she could reach more students, readers, more people beyond just her limited 1, 2, 3 classes each semester. Young adult novels, poetry, essays was a way to share some of these lessons with broader audiences. You also see, for someone like Audre Lorde, she was teaching her CUNY classes on subjects like race and the urban situation. She taught one of the first women's studies classes, especially one of the first to emphasize Black women, called American Women in Black and White. She was teaching these at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Just throw that in there. She was teaching police officers and civilians. She was teaching these classes 5 years before she started writing the essays that would later make her famous. So her collection, Sister Outsider, published in 1984, that's what she's the most famous, kind of expanded her audience beyond. She'd been writing poetry prior to that, but Sister Outsider and her essays are really what I think solidified her reputation over the years and expanded her readership. And in those early CUNY classes, she is studying the questions of race, class, gender, and sexuality that she would then end up writing about in those essays. And she was pretty explicit about this. She said, "I teach myself an outline." She said that in one of the poems that she wrote. And her syllabi are these really precise, beautifully organized, detailed outlines. It'll be like structural racism, point A, B, C, and D. It'll be like whiteness and oppression, points 1, point 1, point 2. And they're very organized. And there are these outlines that she then builds on in those later essays that she would write. If you think about it, like, she needed to pay the bills. She was a mother. She had a family. She had kids to take care of. And teaching provided a way for her to pay the bills and also reach a generation of students. But it also allowed her to do that really concrete research on race, gender, and sexuality that would inform her later work. She also said that teaching basic writing was what taught her how to write prose. Before teaching basic writing, she was really a poet. She didn't write prose, but the experience of figuring out how do you teach writing to students, that gave her the confidence and the skills that inspired her to start writing her own prose. And actually, both Lorde and Rich, this is the fun fact that I love, they both say that teaching writing was how they learned English grammar. They said prior to teaching writing, we just wrote. We didn't really know what the rules for commas and semicolons and clauses. They didn't know those. But it was the experience of actually having to figure out how to teach those to students that then helped them understand how punctuation and how verb tenses work, which is really interesting. So I look at these kind of individual examples about how their writing was shaped by their teaching. But then throughout the book, I look at these three genres that kind of proliferated during this time period. So I call these the genres of open admissions. There's the classroom lyric, the campus essay, and then the anthology of student writing. So one of the things I'm really fascinated in is the way that June Jordan and Toni Cade Bambara would both publish their students' writing in anthologies that then went on to become like really groundbreaking landmark collections. So you have Bambara included her students' writing in her anthology, The Black Woman, right? This very groundbreaking text of Black feminism that she edited in 1970. And then you have June Jordan including her students' writing in her anthology of African American poetry called Soul Script. And so you see them publishing their students' writing as a way to help connect their students to audiences beyond the classroom, right? To give them a sense that like their classroom learning mattered and what they were studying and researching, they could use that to make an impact. And oftentimes these collections addressed absences in the literary and cultural record, right? People were like hungry for these narratives, for these perspectives that the students had that they had cultivated. And these books became widely popular. They sold really well. And I think through that, these teacher poets allowed their students to take the lessons of their lived experiences, coupled with the research they had done, and share the perspectives that they had developed with readers across the country, with students in other classrooms. And I think it honored the desire that the students had for relevant learning, and it honored the experiential knowledge that they brought to the classroom. And so Both Jordan and Bambara would continue publishing anthologies of student writing for the rest of their careers. I think I counted and it was something like they published over a dozen anthologies collectively of student writing throughout their careers.
It's so amazing and so powerful because, again, it's bringing a set of new realities into the world, right? Because, again, education is a great thing, but it can also be a cudgel to make sure that you stay within a certain kind of trajectory. And it kills the imagination. We have a very cheapened notion of the imagination under those circumstances. This is so inspiring, and it makes you want to go out and experiment and think of things beyond what you used to do. And now I have to take us into the present day, because I think that it would be wrong to think of this as a historical artifact that was of its particular time and nothing could be brought forward from it. And I think today, I think you would agree, today we need it more than ever. How do you see this taking place today? And there are roughly two options. They're not mutually exclusive by any means, but you might have other options that you've thought of too, Ephanie, looking at the landscape today. One is, what kinds of ways can we covertly create these spaces in the academy? Secondly, there's also a long tradition of all sorts of learning going on outside the academy. So how do you see this kind of spirit, let's say, continuing either in or out of the academy? What are your thoughts in general, looking at the world today? Of course, you know, we should also say, harking back to neoliberal attacks on the university from the 80s even, it's not sudden. We've managed to survive, but this is particularly challenging. So what are your thoughts on this?
I like that you brought up the importance of educational spaces beyond the academy. I think one of the things I look at in the chapter on Toni K. Bambara is about how she and the other teacher poets continued to fight the encroaching neoliberalism of higher education. And sometimes that meant teaching in other spaces because neoliberalism was pushing out working class students of color, the students she wanted to work with. Yeah. It was pushing them out of the academy by further privatizing higher education, making it more of a pay-to-play system, removing funding for things like open admissions and remedial education programs that brought these students into the academy in the first place. And so you do see later in her career, she focuses a lot of her energies on teaching in neighborhood institutions. And she brought her pedagogy to the Neighborhood Arts Center in Atlanta in the 70s. And then in the 80s and 90s, she worked with the Scribe Community Visions Project in Philadelphia. So she was teaching documentary filmmaking to like local activists and community organizers and using a lot of the methods that she had developed throughout her career. So yeah, so just reminding ourselves that the university, at the same time that we fight for greater investment in those open admissions or remedial education type programs, the learning is also happening elsewhere. And that can be a really viable site, especially as poor people are increasingly pushed out of the university by these neoliberal policies. So in terms of thinking about today, one thing that I hope people take out of this book is we don't have to settle for the current system that we have, right? So at present, we have the system that's fueled by student debt. We have $1.8 trillion of student debt. We have neoliberal austerity is increasing the disparities between affluent students and poor students and the kinds of education that they have access to. And our current system relies on the exploitation of adjunct labor. Yeah. And looking at this earlier era, I want people to be inspired and remember that when we hear politicians talk about free college, it's not a pipe dream. It's actually a very tangible, possible reality that we've had in the past.
Yeah.
City College was free for 130 years. They've only had tuition for 50. So City College has a much longer history as a free institution than it does as a paid kind of pay-to-play type system. I'm hoping that kind of re-inspires us to commit to that vision that college should be free and that actually living in a world where everyone has access to college and can attend as much college as they want, that actually benefits all of us as a society and not just the individuals who choose to attend college. So that's one thing that I hope people take away. Another is, as you've been saying, just a reminder that the classrooms are sites of radical possibilities. That's, of course, bell hooks's phrase, but just that they can be transformative sites where we can push back against fascism, authoritarianism, right, and really challenge the neoliberal status quo by doing things, helping students understand the material conditions in which their lives are unfolding, giving them opportunities to research the social issues they care about, and helping equip them with the skills that they need to do that research. Helping them, and this is something I was thinking about actually reading your book, creating opportunities for them to practice speaking up and using their voices to talk about issues they care about. I know, like in my classes, the students are always leading lessons. Almost every class, the students are going to the front of the classroom and leading lessons. In my more advanced classes, I leave like the last third of the semester blank. And so they decide what topics they want to talk about in the fashion of Bambara. Yeah. And they're doing the research and deciding what we're going to assign. So they can articulate their questions. What are the things they want to know? And then practice, okay, how am I going to answer those questions? How do I create a bibliography of texts that are going to help me study this issue? And then how am I going to teach that to the class? And then actually last semester, my students created an online journal of literary and cultural analysis that's going to publish the writing of our students at SUNY Cortland. Wonderful. So again, it's like creating those opportunities for them to practice speaking up, doing the research, and articulating the visions that they have for a better world and creating platforms and venues for them to do that.
Wow. That's so impressive and so inspiring. And the book is really a marvel. And I thought numerously as I was reading it, all these June Jordan, Audre Lorde, Adrienne Rich, Toni Capeman, they're like deities. But what your book brings out is they're flesh and blood. They were like adults, but they were relearning so much. And that that courage and that ethical sense that there's more that should be thought of and being open to being taught in unconventional ways and to disrupt the power structures and the egos that come with being a professor or a teacher is just inspiring and gives us a kind of guide for how to live our lives as teachers in a really powerful way. So I really can't thank you enough. This book is just a gem and it's a treasure and there's so much in it. I urge everybody to read it, put it on your syllabi if you're a teacher. And please come back and talk more about whatever you're up to. Do you have any projects going on now that you want folks to know about?
Sure. So it's very early stages, but I'm working on a project tentatively called The Radical Writers of Livingston College. So it's a part two, almost a follow-up to this book. There was this experimental public institution that briefly existed at Rutgers in the 1970s, where they were, when we think of experimental education, we often think of schools maybe like Hampshire and Reed, these expensive elite schools. But Livingston was invented in 1969 to try to involve working class students and students of color and give them the opportunity to experiment and do things differently. And it was entirely like designed by students, encouraged faculty to experiment. They're like, do things differently. And it attracted Sonia Sanders, Sanchez, Nikki Giovanni, Bambara taught there. She left SEEK and she went right to Livingston. Hattie Gossett, Jane Cortez, all of these big names of Black feminist literature were teaching at Livingston at this experimental college that was designed to be a school that would address social issues in local communities. And so I'm looking at their teaching. I'm trying to tell the story of this college that I don't think many people had heard about. And it seemed like they were really pioneering some exciting teaching methods. I love spending time in the archives, obviously.
Yeah.
So yeah, hopefully that will lead to some new teaching experiments in my own classes. And yeah, so that's what I've been working on.
The door's open. Anytime you want to come back, either we don't have to wait for the book necessarily to be out, although we'll do that too. But if you just want to check in and just hang out, it'd be wonderful to spend more time with you. Thank you so much.
That sounds great. Thank you so much, David. This was such a wonderful experience. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah. Okay. Take care. Have a good rest of your day.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.